Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Protest against the construction of pipelines in Pennsylvania has been commonplace over the past few years. Often homeowners don't want pipelines near where they live because they believe the pipelines will damage the looks of their homes, property values will go down, or that there is a danger to the environment. However, there are those who see another kind of danger, and it elicits fear. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reported on and researched this fear of pipelines, and she tells us about it on today's program. Marie, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Scott.
So we've heard the reasons that those who oppose pipelines being located near their homes object. And even though they may say a pipeline could be dangerous, they often don't use the word fear. What in particular are people afraid of?
Well, I want to just say it's not simply people who oppose pipelines who are afraid. People who live next to pipelines, they may feel good about it, they may feel bad about it, they may feel neutral. So I'm not trying to tell anyone how to feel, but I was interested in why some people are very afraid of pipelines. People talk about living in the blast zone. If there's an explosion or an accident, that they would be incinerated. Of course, that's terrifying. But really, incidents involving pipelines are actually very rare. So I was interested in exploring why is it that certain things like pipelines make us afraid.
All right, before we get into that, how rare are incidents involving pipelines?
On average, in the U.S., pipelines kill about 17 people per year, and they injure about 65 people per year, according to federal data from the past 20 years.
I would have to say, though, there's probably some people who may be surprised that 17 people a year die from pipelines. What do they die from? How are they killed?
Yeah, well, I'll say there are, you know, three main types of pipelines. There's gathering lines that move gas from the wells to larger pipelines. There's the big transmission lines. Those are like the super highways transporting gas or oil over long distances. And then there's distribution lines that go right in directly into your home or business or to service you. So people can be killed from incidents involving any type. In fact, there was a UGI worker who was killed last summer in Lancaster County, and it was, you know, from a gas leak in a residential community that he was trying to address. So it can be any sort of things. But in particular, what we've been seeing in Pennsylvania is a big building boom of new natural gas pipelines to service the Marcellus shale industry. So we're having more gathering lines, more transmission lines. We already have a lot of pipelines all around us. We have distribution lines all over the place. So really, I just got interested because I thought, wow, there's this sort of spider web of pipelines that we have lived with for decades, but now people see new ones going in.
So even with those numbers, as you said, the risk of death from a pipeline explosion, for example, or maybe even a leak, is low compared to other risks, like, say, a car crash, maybe even slipping in the bathtub. I'm sure, I don't know what those numbers are, but I'm sure there probably are more deaths from slipping in the bathtub. But yet that fear exists. Why?
Yeah, well, that's because when you or I think about riskiness, we're not thinking about probable fatalities and statistics. Those don't really mean a lot to people necessarily. You know, as I was doing this story, I tried to think of some of my own fears, and I have what I consider to be a very irrational fear of tornadoes. We do get tornadoes here sometimes, but I've just always been really afraid of them, and they're not really likely to hurt me here. They really hit on, for me, tornadoes hit on kind of the three things that pipelines also hit on, and I can kind of talk to you about what those are. There's three main things.
What are those three things?
Well, there's a sense of dread. So it's not how you die, it's the nature of your death. So think about a shark attack, for example. That is a horrible way to die. And in fact, a man in Massachusetts was killed recently by a shark. It's horrific and tragic. Sharks kill about 6 people per year globally. So that's not a lot of people, given how many people, perhaps billions of people, go swimming each year in the oceans. But there's that sense of dread. Same for me with tornadoes. It's like, horrible. It could also kill a lot of people and be catastrophic. So it could, that plays into it. And then there's a sense of familiarity as well. So there's dread, familiarity. If something feels less familiar to you, it can also be scarier. So if you think about getting in your car is actually quite a risky thing to do, or it can't, there are a lot of deaths from car accidents and car crashes. But it's very familiar. We do it every day and we're kind of used to it. Whereas something like a pipeline, we just don't interface with it. We don't interact with it. There's also a sense of control. So there's a lack of a sense of control here. Most people, especially if it's one of these big transmission lines that's being built around here, they didn't ask for this. They didn't sign up for it. It's not a risk that they took on themselves. So think about flying an airplane versus driving a car. Again, statistically speaking, flying in an airplane is extremely safe versus driving in a car. But in the car, you may feel like you not only have that familiarity, but you also have that sense of control. You are behind the steering wheel.
I want to get back to, we can talk about each one of those, but getting back to that sense of dread. And by that, I think you mean that it's not that someone is afraid of actually being dead. It's how that occurs. And you used the example of a shark attack. Same thing with a pipeline explosion or something having to do with natural gas?
Yeah, and I'll reiterate, people feel differently about this. Some people are totally fine with it. Other people couldn't care less, and other people are really afraid. So it just depends on who you are and how you feel, and there's no right or wrong way to feel. But yes, that sense of dread is a factor that plays into how we perceive risk. So it's also very easy to understand if you see on the news huge fireballs and people getting hurt or people dying. It's just a very clear and horrific and tragic thing that's easy to understand.
When people feel they're not in control, and let's face it, when it comes to where a pipeline is going to be built, where it's going to go, very often the public has very little control over that. I mean, that would seem to promote a sense of dread right there. Okay, I'm using dread in a different context, but a sense of dread right there. It's the unknown. This is something I have no control. I can complain. I can go to a government agency. I can go to the utility. I can go to the company building it. But the bottom line is, even though I do all those things, it still may happen. That loss of control, explain why that makes people fearful.
Well, particularly with these big transmission gas pipelines that are going in, they're really built, like I said, to be sort of the superhighways moving the gas long distances. So in many cases, the companies are granted eminent domain and they're allowed to build it through people's property, whether they agree to it or not. They do have to compensate them. But it's not really like it's directly benefiting the people necessarily living next to it. So if you think about risks you may take in your life, we are open to taking risks, of course, but that's often because we derive a benefit. So, for example, many people drink too much alcohol on a regular basis. We all know that's drinking too much is a dangerous thing to do. But hey, many people like having a couple drinks at the end of the night, or smoking cigarettes. People know that's also dangerous to their health, but they like to smoke a cigarette. So if you choose to take a risk, then and you derive a benefit, then you feel better about it generally than if somebody imposes a risk onto you and you don't get a benefit.
Does the industry downplay these fears?
That's a good question. I don't know that they do, but I do know from, you know, attending many industry conferences over the years that they are acutely aware that they need to have a better public relations strategy around pipelines. They feel like people just don't understand that, you know, gas, it heats your home, it powers factories, it generates electricity. Like, there are all these services we are providing, and kind of you, the public, may not understand us. But I don't know that it's about understanding, like I said, fatality statistics that are low, or injury statistics, or, you know, listing the costs and the risks and the benefits. I think it's more that people need to feel like they're heard on both sides of an issue. If you're trying to communicate if you're a risk communicator and you're trying to tell people what the risks are, you also need to be a good listener and understand why people are feeling the way they're feeling and not be dismissive of it.
A lot of this, I would imagine, has to do with perception as well. The Mariner East 2 pipeline, for example, has had a number of spills. A lot of Chester County residents, for example, have come out in protest of that. There has been a lot of media coverage of some of those incidents. People that live along that line and see that, maybe not just Mariner East 2, but other pipelines as well, they see this media coverage. They see the problems. I mean, it would seem to say that that would promote even more fear.
Right. And just like shark attacks, you get media saturation of those events, and they're very rare. But that does play into people's perception of risks. I'll also add that whether or not the person imposing the risk on you is somebody that you trust also matters. So in the particular case of the Mariner East 2, the company building it, they don't have a great track record of talking to people effectively. I know, as a reporter, just trying to reach out to them to get feedback and comments for stories. I mean, they don't even respond to phone calls. They may send you a long email with a statement that may or may not answer your question. But that factor of trust matters too.
See, you know, Marie, when I think about that, you would think that the company would understand. You know, and that's why I asked that question of whether the companies building these pipelines downplay the fears, because this is their business. This is what they do. They see those numbers and they probably think this is a very safe thing. You look at our safety record, and they probably maybe they don't understand the fears that people living along that line will have, because this is what they do on a regular basis. Just like getting in a car and driving every day, this is what they do every day.
I will say, though, having interacted with many companies over the years, from a public relations standpoint, some are good, some are bad. You know, they're not all the same. Some of them actually do answer the phone a lot. But that pipeline in particular is basically an export pipeline. So again, you have something that they're building, and even if you rattle off safety statistics, it's a risk that's imposed on you, and you may not be necessarily benefiting from it, and it's running through your property with or without your permission.
State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick. Marie, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And you can read more about fear of pipelines and a whole lot of other items. Marie has produced a feature on pipelines by going to WITF.org/State Impact Pennsylvania. Welcome back to this portion of Smart Talk. The AARP Foundation has released a report that focuses on loneliness among adults age 45 and older. It found there are millions of Americans who are lonely, and some more than others. AARP's Lisa Marsh Ryerson joined us to explain. Lisa Marsh Ryerson, president of the AARP Foundation, welcome to Smart Talk.
Oh, Scott, it's just a delight to be on Smart Talk. Thanks for having me.
The AARP Foundation's Loneliness and Social Connections Among Adults Age 45 and Older. So why did you do this? Why did the AARP Foundation do this?
Well, you know, Scott, AARP Foundation works to end senior poverty by increasing economic opportunity and social connections among older adults. And when we began this work in 2010, we fielded the first survey on loneliness. And given all that's changed in the past 8 years, when you think about technology and the use of social media, we felt it was important to refield the survey on loneliness and social connections, and we're able to do so because of the generous support of Consumer Cellular.
Well, let's talk about loneliness. I mean, this is a bit of a unique poll or research, if you will, because usually we're asking the public questions about political candidates or where they stand on issues. Not very often are we asking the public to answer questions about their personal lives or what's important to them. So 1 in 3 U.S. adults age 45 and older are lonely. Explain that.
Yeah, Scott, you're right. And so when you think about that number, one in three of adults who are 45 and older, and then you think about the good news of an aging population and a growing number of older adults, we recognize that this is a serious problem that has to be addressed. So loneliness, Scott, is our own perception of how we're feeling. And in a world that feels ever more connected, here we are with a growing public health concern of loneliness and social isolation. It has very negative health outcomes, Scott. If you are lonely or socially isolated for a prolonged period of time, the health consequences are equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
Wow.
Right.
That's incredible.
Well, it's incredible.
You know, one of the things that this may be a little bit counterintuitive, not that 45 and older Americans are like the demographic that is using social media most often. I mean, we often think of that, and maybe it's a stereotype, of that being younger people. But even today, when any age American has access to social media, you would think that there would be more older Americans who would feel less lonely because they would be more connected through social media. Is that the case?
Well, you know, it is true. A couple things, Scott, that you're highlighting. I mean, certainly more of us are using social media and technology. So we are seeing a rise in numbers among older adults who are using the tools and or being trained to use the tools to facilitate, just as you're suggesting, connection with family members who live farther away or if they've relocated, friends and neighbors. But here's what it highlights. Although those tools are helpful for us to remain connected, in no way are they substitutes for human connection. So in some senses, we're online so much, are we taking the time to get offline and connect with one another in a more personal manner? It's so important, Scott.
What the research also found is that there are certain groups of people who are probably more likely to be lonely. Who are some of those groups? Who are some of those people?
Sure. It really did show information about significant increase in risk for some populations. So, Scott, that can include and does include individuals who are unpaid caregivers who are reaching out and helping someone as a caregiver, but that can be a very isolating experience. And also low-income individuals. And, Scott, when you and I think about that, if your resources are strained, and you don't even have enough resources to meet the essentials in your life, you certainly don't have income or resources to take advantage of social activities or remain connected to your network. And also, Scott, individuals who identify as LGBTQ are at far greater risk for loneliness and social isolation.
And again, that doesn't surprise very many people out there, I'm sure.
It doesn't.
But there are a few activities out there that help to reduce the rate of loneliness. And let's talk about them. Exercise is one. Why is exercise helpful in preventing someone from being lonely?
Yeah, so you're right about exercise. And in fact, that's significant as well because 41% of older adults who do not exercise are lonely. So when we have the data right on the health benefits of exercise. And when we think about health as including well-being, emotional health, and connections, we know that exercise, it may take us outdoors. We might be walking our dog, connecting with our neighbors, going to a class at the local Y, senior center, or community center, where we have more opportunity to connect with other adults or individuals who are also enjoying that activity. So I don't know about you, Scott, but I'm going to pay much more attention now to trying to stick to my exercise routine.
I have to say I thought the same thing when I saw the results of the research. All right, another activity, and this probably is good and bad news for some people, but I'm sure there will be some people who will use it and think about it, and that is sex lives with older adults. What did the research find?
Yeah, the research, again, was really clear here and found that older adults who are still in close relationships and connecting with one another through sex are not as lonely as those who are not. And when you think about that, Scott, for me, it underscores, again, the importance of maintaining meaningful relationships across our lifespan and across our health span, maintaining that contact through relationship.
So one of the reasons that you wanted to do this research was to help reduce loneliness. Today, September 28th, is National Good Neighbor Day, and what AARP is encouraging people to do is to connect with your neighbors so that maybe that does reduce loneliness. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, happy National Good Neighbor Day, everyone. We wanted to really leverage the opportunity of this day, which has been on the calendar since President Carter was in office and signed it in as a special day on our calendar. And our hope is that National Good Neighbor Day on September 28th is an introduction to raise awareness about the negative health impacts of loneliness and social isolation. And it provides an opportunity for each of us to be a more intentional, thoughtful, frankly, a better neighbor. In fact, Scott, the research showed that for older adults who do not know their neighbors, 64% are lonely. So the very fact of being a good neighbor is improving your neighbor's health. And you know what? It improves ours, too. Every time we reach out and help someone, I know for me, I feel better in the giving of myself to others.
You know, though, I'm thinking about this. I'm thinking about situations in my own life, observations I've made,
sure,
where there have been parents or other relatives, friends, who were older adults and they lost their spouse. Their spouse passed away, someone that they were married to for 40, 50, 60 years. And what I often heard, and this is nothing new, I'm sure a lot of people hear this, is that after the week or 2 weeks after the death of that spouse, so many people stop by, offer their condolences, offer their help, offer their assistance, just sit and talk. But then after that 2 or 3 week period goes by, that person becomes very lonely because not as many people are showing up, not as many people are sitting there and talking or visiting. What about that? I mean, how do you overcome that?
You know, Scott, you're really hitting on a key issue because the loss of a spouse or a partner, a loved one, is a real trigger or indicator for increased risk of loneliness and isolation. And I just know from my own experience that you're right. We do the right thing and the heartfelt thing of reaching out immediately, and then our lives go on, right? So my recommendation is just be mindful and on the lookout for those individuals and relatives who've had a loss, who might be living on their own, who might be chronically ill and disconnected from their networks, and stop in more regularly. You know, it doesn't have to take a lot of time. But again, a cup of coffee, a cup of tea, a ride to the grocery store, really, really important, especially in those times of loss.
Lisa Marsh Ryerson, president of the AARP Foundation, thank you very much for being with us today.
Scott, I've so enjoyed talking with you. Thanks for covering this important topic.
And thank you. You can find more details of that research on our website, WITF.org, under the Smart Talk, today's description of the program. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. It is the last day of WITF's fall fundraising campaign. I'm joined by Joe Ulrich. Joe, welcome to Smart Talk.
Thanks for having me this morning, Scott. And you've been having a rather interesting conversation this morning, the talk of pipelines and Marie's conversation about, you know, why some people fear things like that. I thought that was very interesting. I definitely was learning a few things there. And the conversation about loneliness, too, I think that's something that is you know, something that we all face at some point, and is something that even if we're not facing it, probably somebody in our lives is facing it. And I'm just really enjoying this conversation, you know, and this kind of conversation I'm just not really hearing many other places in the media. This is a great conversation that you're having. It's a long form conversation, and this is what I want when I listen to WITF. I love to learn things, and I like to learn about new things. And you know, if this is valuable to you, it's our fall fundraising campaign. It's the last day, Scott. We've got got just over $12,000 to reach, and we want to reach that goal because it helps us to continue to do programs like this and for you to be able to have conversations like this. You can get involved and make a show of support right now at WITF.org or 1-800-233-9483.
Yeah, I just thought about it, Joe, as you were describing it, but the first segment of the program, we were talking about fear. That was, even though it was in context with fear of pipelines and fear of some type of disaster, but then the second part, talking about loneliness, I don't know, two emotions or two things that aren't very pleasant, but yeah. That issues that have to be dealt with, that everyone has dealt with at one time or another.
That's right.
And you're right that you don't hear those kind of conversations very many places. I can't stress enough that the fall fundraising campaign is a very important time of year for WITF. It is the last time during this fall fundraising campaign, during Smart Talk, that we will be fundraising. I always encourage the Smart Talk audience that if you tune into the program, maybe once a week, maybe every day, we hope you tune in every day, and you do appreciate that a local and a locally owned station, locally run station, operated station, if you appreciate the kind of conversations that you hear on an everyday basis and having the ability to engage with our guests and have your opinion known, well, then we ask for your financial support by going to WITF.org/givenow or call 1-800-233-9483. Joe, it's been a busy week.
It has been a really busy week, and we've had a lot of contributions coming in, and it's yesterday was a busy day, too. We were airing the entire coverage of the Kavanaugh hearings, and we didn't do any fundraising during that time. We're a news station, and breaking news was happening, and we covered it, and so we didn't do any fundraising for, gosh, I think it was about 8 hours yesterday as we covered that. And so, if that's important to you to hear breaking news like that, then consider showing your support right here at WITF.org or 1-800-233-9483. And we've seen a great show of support here during Smart Talk already. Randy in Lutherville, Mary-Kate in Harrisburg, Elizabeth Lancaster, Kelly in Anvil, Christy in Willow Street, Sean in Harrisburg, Sylvia in East Berlin. Thank you all so much for your support. You make Smart Talk and all the great programs possible when you make a contribution at WITF.org or 1-800-233-9483.
Thanks, Joe, and we'll be talking to you again in just a few minutes.
All right.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR news and all things regional. The novel An American Marriage by Thierry Jones was chosen by Oprah Winfrey as one of her 2018 book club selections. That's one of the highest honors a book and an author can get today. An American Marriage is also WITF's September Pick of the Month. Not quite on the scale of Oprah Winfrey, but still a book that WITF and Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg highly recommend. In fact, Ms. Jones will appear at Midtown Scholar Bookstore on October 11th during the Harrisburg Book Festival. She is with us today to discuss the book and her career. Tahari Jones, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So with novels, we're not going to give too much information away because we want everyone to read the book, but just to describe An American Marriage, it's the story of young newlywed Celestial and Roy. They're married for about a year and a half, and even though they do have their disagreements, they're in love. But while visiting Roy's hometown in Louisiana, Roy is arrested for a crime he didn't commit, and he's sent to prison for a long time. Now, again, we don't want to give away too much. That sets up the story. But I have to say, Ms. Jones, that I'm fascinated by how this story came about, An American Marriage. It's fascinating. You saw a real couple at a mall in Atlanta or near Atlanta. Tell us about what you witnessed and how it turned into a novel.
Well, at the time, I was doing a fellowship at Harvard to do research on the issue of mass incarceration. And I had done a lot of research, and I learned a lot of really harrowing statistics, but I didn't have a story. You know, I'm not a sociologist. I'm not a political scientist. I'm a storyteller. I'm a novelist, and I couldn't find a story. And I was really upset, and I didn't know what to do because I had to show something for my research, and I didn't have anything but a bunch of index cards. Well, I was in the mall in Atlanta, and I overheard a couple arguing in the mall. I heard the woman say, clear as a bell, she said, "Roy, you know you wouldn't have waited on me for 7 years." And then he said, "I don't know what you're talking about. This wouldn't have happened to you in the first place." And for me, I know I have a novel when I'm in a position where both characters are right, yet they disagree. Because that's when you know you have moral ambiguity. And so I decided to write about a young couple that are torn apart by the husband's wrongful incarceration and the way this affected their lives, their families, and the way that they understand themselves as Americans as they walk into the future.
So I'm curious, you overheard this argument. How long was it going on? Because what I'm picturing is in just a few minutes of overhearing this disagreement between this couple, you wrote a novel that goes on for 300 pages.
Well, you know, real life things for me only provide the spark. And I like to think of it as a spark, and the whole novel, you know, is the flame. And, you know, it only takes one drop match or, you know, one drop cigarette to start a fire, and that's what happened. I only listened to them probably less than a minute.
And it became a novel from that. And I'm curious, has that been, I hate to say your MO, but I mean, obviously this is not your first novel, but have there been real-life motivations or real-life incidents, things that you've witnessed like this, that you say, you know what, this will turn into a great story?
No, this novel was really different than the others in that, you know, my earlier novels were more inspired by either my literal autobiography or what I like to call my emotional autobiography. And with the fourth novel, I decided that it was time for me to, you know, reach for something outside of myself, a problem bigger than my own musings. And I was really caught flat-footed. I thought that the library held, you know, I thought the story was in the library. And I just feel that it was just like a gift of fate that I encountered these people who, you know, gave me what I needed.
So the bigger issue here, I mean, and there are several social issues, several issues that we deal with Americans in this country every day. But one is mass incarceration of black men in particular. And you said that you had a fellowship at Harvard. Tell us why that became such a part of this story. I have to say that it is not the major part of the story. I mean, obviously, what happens in the story, that has it's significant, but it is not commentary on black men being incarcerated on a mass scale.
Well, you know, I was always taught that you should write about people and their problems, not problems and their people. So for me, when I engage with a social issue in my writing, I kind of have it almost like the soundtrack, but it's not the thing on the fourth stage, because it's always going to be the way that people interact. I've always, all my life, I've been aware of prison, you know, kind of looming in the background of African-American life. It's funny because sometimes people think that, you know, perhaps I had some kind of lightning bolt experience with mass incarceration, but I feel like it's almost like rather than having been struck by lightning by this issue, that in my community it's just raining all the time.
You used the name Roy. That was one of the main characters. Roy was the name of the young man that you witnessed having this argument with his, we assume, girlfriend. The book takes place in Atlanta and Louisiana. You went to Spelman College. Both characters went to Spelman. So you're mixing real life with a fictional story. This story probably could have happened anywhere, but where Roy is arrested and falsely accused of a crime and convicted of a crime was Louisiana. That was, they were visiting his parents in Louisiana, decided to stay at a hotel. Why Louisiana? That is significant in the story.
Well, two reasons. One, you know, Louisiana has the highest rate of incarceration of any state in the U.S., and some argue of, you know, the population, the percentage of the population that's incarcerated, is one of the highest in the world, for one. But more personally, my own father is from a small town in Louisiana, and he moved to Atlanta, you know, to seek his fortune. And there's so much talk about the Great Migration in terms of people moving from the, black people moving from the South to the North, but there was a lot of migration within the South. And so I also wanted to kind of, you know, tip my hat and acknowledge that own part of my own family story. So Roy moved to Atlanta. It's the promised land for him. And he goes back home to visit his family, and he's arrested. And he feels like, you know, he felt like he had escaped, and then this, like, a, it was almost like a statistic jumped out of the closet and snatched him, you know? So the disappointment he feels with that is also compounded with his, you know, the way anyone would feel about being arrested for a crime they didn't commit. But this just was another layer.
We're speaking with Tayari Jones, who is the author of the novel An American Marriage, and the book was an Oprah Winfrey 2018 Book Club selection, also WITF September Pick of the Month. Ms. Jones will be in Harrisburg at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore on October 11th. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I'm getting a lot of questions here from listeners about the Oprah Winfrey aspect to this, but and we'll get to that in just a moment. But something I want to talk about, a couple aspects of the book that are very unique. One is that each chapter is told from the perspective of the characters. Why'd you decide to do that?
You know, I wrote the novel the first time all from the point of view of the wife, because I was really interested in what they call the collateral effects of incarceration. How did this affect this young woman? Her whole life is ahead of her. She's an artist. Her career is starting to happen. And her kind of American dream marriage is destroyed by this incarceration. So I wrote the whole thing from her point of view, but it didn't seem to be the whole story. So then I rewrote it. I wrote the whole thing from his point of view, a young man just out of college, feeling like everything is ahead of him, and he is the one that's wrongfully incarcerated, and his views on it. And I felt that draft was good, but it felt a little overly familiar. I felt like I was approaching the story in a fairly obvious way, and it didn't have enough emotional and ideological and intellectual surprises for me, because I felt it was a story I knew before I started to write it. So then I decided to toggle their two points of view, and I felt like I was getting closer, but then I decided to add a third viewpoint, and when I had the three of them, I felt like, oh, this is the story, this is the whole thing.
And it certainly is unique, and it's a great way to write the book. Something else that is very different is that you see how Celestial and Roy's relationship plays out while he is in prison through letters that they write to one another. They start out as sad love letters, but they become darker as time goes by. And we're not just talking about a couple, a few. We're talking about quite a few letters between the couple while Roy is in prison. Again, the idea for that, how did it come about? And it allowed you to do a lot of things talking about their relationship because it's in the intimacy of a letter.
Well, I write lots of letters in real life. I write probably about 5 or 6 letters a week. And I would like to say that people do not write me back. I don't know what's wrong with people. But I love writing letters. And prison is an environment where people still rely on letters like people did in the old days. So that was one. And secondly, you know, prison is brutality. And when you read, you experience what the characters experience vicariously. And I had to figure out a way that I could talk about Roy's experience in prison without taking you as a reader to prison, but without sugarcoating what his experience was. And letters were perfect because we find out of his experience the things he would choose to share with his wife. So he spares her the details, but he doesn't spare her his emotional life. So that was a way that the reader then could emotionally understand what he's going through without without the harrowing details of prison. But the fun thing I noticed, fun probably isn't the right word, but when I was writing their letters and their relationship, I realized that Celestial and Roy are facing the same challenges of other couples. It's just because of his situation, the conflict is like turned up all the way to the max. You know, her career is thriving, and he can't have a career because he's in prison. So that's like a higher level of the same problem many modern couples face. What happens when a woman is the one who's out in front?
You know, something I just realized as we're sitting here talking about it is in the letters, you're right, that Roy describes prison life, almost every story, almost to a T, every one, when someone is incarcerated, you hear about what they're going through, the fears, being a target in prison, all those kind of things. Prison life becomes the story, but you do it in a way that he lets Celestial know that he's unhappy and that he is facing a lot of these challenges, but you don't describe them. He doesn't describe them to her.
I instead had to rely on what I like to call the minutiae of deprivation. When I was doing my research, I read a number of oral histories of incarcerated people, and when I was reading them, I was looking for small things that could show you but not traumatize you as a reader. Like, I read about a man who was deeply ashamed because of a way that he had gone about acquiring a very small onion. Just a mundane detail, an onion, something we take for granted. But, you know, he just said that was the one of the flavor he craved all these years. And the fact that you would be so deprived that you would risk killing someone for an onion. And so I remembered that. And when I was working on my book, instead of an onion is just not a very poetic vegetable. I used a pear, but this craving for just something fresh to eat. So I tried to think of small things like that, or the idea that when the lack of privacy, that you aren't even private in the bathroom, just small things so that the reader can see what Roy has been robbed of.
We have a caller, Faith, from Lancaster Township. I'm not going to be able to get her on the air, but her question was, what do you know about compensation for falsely imprisoned people?
You know, most people don't get anything at all, actually. I mean, there are some high-profile cases where people have sued and are able to get major compensation. But most people, all you get is your freedom. That's it.
I think that we're hearing more and more cases of people who have been released or have been exonerated. And, you know, you don't often hear about the compensation afterwards. Sometimes there is some, but as you just pointed out, so often there is not. I have a question here from a listener, and I know that this is a big question that many people have. And that is, what does it mean to be a novelist, to become an Oprah book?
You know, this is my fourth novel, so I feel really kind of grateful that this happened at this point in my career, because I feel like I already knew what I did and why. But it is exciting. You know, I've been writing for years. You know, my books have done well enough for me. I felt very satisfied that they reached people who needed who needed the message I was sending. And I had convinced myself, I felt that that was my calling, really, that I was a person who wrote novels that were meaningful to a small group of people. And I was grateful that I was able to do my life's work. But just imagine, I was driving my car, and there was a mysterious blocked call, and I answer it, and it's Oprah Winfrey on the phone, and she's saying that she wants to use my book for her book club. And I was really stunned and excited, but the more I thought about it, I realized that Oprah Winfrey was providing me the gift of her good name. She was lending her good name to my work. And it really made me think of all the other times in my life when people have lent me their good name. Like when I wanted to go to college, my high school counselor, she lent her good name to my application to secure my future. She's not Oprah Winfrey, but in that gift of her name, she was making the same gesture. And so it just made me really grateful for all the help I've ever received in my life.
Well, it's probably not as widespread as many people know about the book as WITF and Midtown Scholar Bookstore's Pick of the Month. But I'm looking forward to your appearance in Harrisburg on October 11th. Tayari Jones, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Looking forward to 1A coming up next with the Friday News Roundup with Joshua Johnson. Joe Ulrich is with us right now. Last day of WITF's fall fundraising campaign. And the Smart Talk listeners, the WITF loyal listeners are really coming through for us this morning, but we do need a few more.
Yeah, we've seen an incredible show of support during Smart Talk here. We have a goal of we have remaining $10,000 to go today, a little over $10,000. That's towards our overall goal of $78,000. And just think about Smart Talk and think about all the programs on WITF, like 1A that's coming up next. If this is a part of your daily routine, if you just can't imagine turning on your radio and not having this, consider making a contribution. Help us reach that goal, because your contributions allow us to do Smart Talk. It allows us to pay for programs like 1A and Morning Edition and All Things Considered. It's as simple as that. We have a different funding model than most stations where you make a contribution if you want to. You know, we don't have normal advertisers. We have some local underwriters who help us, but our largest reliable source of funding is you. So when you make a contribution, you are really a part of why Smart Talk is here and why all the great programs are here. And you can help us reach our goal with that contribution at WITF.org or 1-800-233-9483. And for a contribution of $60, Scott, you can have the awesome Smart Talk mug, which I have and I drink my coffee out of in the morning. I wake up and I see Smart Talk and I think, oh, I'm going to have some coffee and then I'm going to have some Smart Talk at 9 o'clock. It's a great way to start my day.
Well, I thank you for that.
You're welcome.
For that, Joe. But, you know, something you just said is so important, that you are the biggest part of what we do at WITF. Okay, now, yes, we're asking for your financial support. If you appreciate, if you enjoy the programming that you hear on WITF. But, Joe, you know this because the two of us sit 10 feet apart. But I get 50 to 100 emails a day just with suggestions for topics for Smart Talk. Now, most of them are coming from like national communications or public relations firms, but many of them are coming from you, the listener, the WITF listener, and or anything that's local that I put right at the top of the list. But you very often have suggestions for Smart Talk topics, topics that you'd like to learn more about. And I appreciate that so much. I wouldn't even have to make a list. Quite frankly, I wouldn't even have to make a list of topics that me and our team here at WITF have come up with to address on Smart Talk, because listeners have so many, and I appreciate that. But what that shows me, Joe, is just, I don't know how listeners feel
listenership.
They are so active and they feel such a part of what we do at WITF.
Well, and you are a part of what we do. I mean, this is, I heard Tim Lambert say it earlier this morning, that you are a part owner in WITF. When you make a contribution, we are a community public radio station and you are a part of us. It's not us and you, it's us together. We're all together in this. You make contributions, you can make suggestions for Smart Talk shows, and we all team up and bring you great public radio every day, great conversations. And, you know, there are those that really can step up that are in a place to be able to do this, who make a $100 contribution a month or a $1,200 a year contribution. And with that, you get to be in our premier circle. Those are, again, people who can are in a spot to make a $100 a month contribution. And with that, you get to meet WITF personalities. And we have a premier circle dinner where we have a special public media guest each year. And this year, it's Melissa Block, former host of All Things Considered. So if you can make that contribution, that's great. If you could do a $5 a month contribution, we have so many of those, and they get us towards our goal. You can make that happen at WITF.org or 1-800-233-9483.
And Melissa Block of NPR will be on Smart Talk when she is here in Harrisburg
cool.
as well.
Yeah.
So, again, Joe Ulrich, thank you very much for being with
us
today. 1-800-233-9483 or go to WITF.org. During October, Smart Talk, we're going to be featuring conversations with the candidates running for the U.S. House of Representatives, the U.S. Senate, and governor of Pennsylvania. Our first will be coming up this Monday, October 1st.